Order.
The Honourable Dr. Jonathan Coleman.
Mr. Speaker, it's a great privilege to be here making a contribution to the debate on the Prime Minister's statement. And I see parallels, Mr. Speaker, between the way Brendan McCullum approaches cricket and the way our Prime Minister approaches politics. Confident, assertive, on the front foot, inspiring. A man that people want to follow, Mr. Speaker. Meanwhile, on the other side of the House, you've got Andrew Little cowering in the dressing room on all fours, looking for his groin protected.
And with the Minister of Health there striving to maintain the standard of cross-chamber sledging set by John Key at the start of the debate on the Prime Minister's statement, the Leader of the House, Gerry Brownlee, moved to park that debate after just one speech on Wednesday afternoon.
Mr. Speaker, following discussions at the Business Committee yesterday, I seek leave for the debate on the Prime Minister's statement to be set down for resumption on Tuesday, the 1st of March, despite Standing Order 2552.
Actually, it's 3552, the standing order that gives debate on the Prime Minister's statement precedence over all other government business. Although the debate has been interrupted for progress on government bills on every day since it began 2 weeks ago, Mr. Brownlee's request for leave cleared all the chamber time remaining in this week, except for questions on Thursday, for debate on government bills and one in particular. The Social Housing Reform Transaction Mandate Bill dominated the week. Its second reading, completed on Tuesday, was followed by a five-hour grind through the committee stage on Wednesday afternoon and evening, clearing the way for its third and final reading before the House adjourned on Thursday evening. For one last time, the House divided down the middle over a bill that, despite its bland title, provoked passionate debate and a conflict of ideologies.
What this bill does is enable the ministers, in this case it would be Minister English and Minister Bennett, it gives them unfettered and extraordinary powers to sell off billions of dollars of publicly owned land and housing that has been built up and paid off by generations of New Zealanders, both taxpayers and state house tenants, with the express purpose of putting a roof over the heads of our most vulnerable citizens. And, sir, we will put the view time and again in the course of this debate that we are utterly opposed to the dismantling and privatisation of that system of housing and social support.
Labour's housing spokesman Phil Twyford putting his party's stake in the ground on Wednesday, with National's Bay of Plenty MP Todd Muller responding for the government in the third reading debate the next day.
Well, Mr. Speaker, it gives me great privilege to stand and support the third reading of the Social Housing Reform Transaction Mandate Bill, particularly to follow abject nonsense and ideological nonsense that we've heard from Phil Twyford over the last 10 minutes. And Mr. Twyford is again on the wrong side of this. And I agree, this will be a defining and is a defining a line between this side of the House and your side of the House over there, Mr. Twyford, because what this bill enables and what this bill talks to is an innovative approach around delivering social services. Are you caught in a paradigm which says only the state can own a house, only the state can provide it, when we have community housing providers that are already in existence? But oh no, for the Labor Party, if it's not Housing New Zealand, it's not good enough.
While National's Todd Muller foresaw community housing groups as the new owners, Green's co-leader Matiria Ture worried about foreign buyers.
These ministers can sell to any corporate entity anywhere in the world, to any major international corporation who may not have any involvement in New Zealand, who may not understand the New Zealand community and have no commitment to making sure that housing remains for the security of our families from time to come.
Matiria Ture's fears were echoed by Dennis O'Rourke, housing spokesman for the New Zealand First Party.
This is just privatisation. You can see it from the objectives, you can see it from the government's records, and it's wrong. This government should be investing more, not selling.
While Dennis O'Rourke's New Zealand First Party joined the Greens and Labour in opposition, Māori Party co-leader Marama Fox explained why her party would join United Futures' Peter Dunn and ACT's David Seymour in giving National the majority it needed to pass the bill.
Everybody's asking, why is the Māori Party voting with the government over this? I'm here to tell you. This is not a vote for a wholesale sell-off of the state housing stock. For us, this is a vote of rangatiratanga, because we have been asked by iwi around this country to support this legislation to ensure that they can get into the social housing market. And why? Because actually the Housing New Zealand have done an appalling job of looking after our people, and they believe that they can do it better. And actually, we believe they can as well.
Māori Party co-leader Marama Fox revealing her party's motives for supporting the government's legislation, giving two of its ministers the power to sell off state houses to anybody from Taranaki to Timbuktu. Also passed on Thursday was a bill providing payment for home and community support workers for travel between clients, as explained by Nationals Whangarei MP Shane Retty.
This bill implements the settlement agreement between the Crown, DHBs, service providers and support workers. This is a very important bill, Mr Speaker. The home and community support workforce is a workforce of 20,000 people servicing and serving roughly 40,000 clients. Now, in the next few weeks, as part of the agreement, the second stage of the reimbursement formula will kick in as of March. Mr Speaker, this bill goes some way to valuing the efforts of our home and community support sector. It does so by pay recognition, a formula that fundamentally measures time and distance. Mr Speaker, I want to recognise what the sector does that is also valuable but can't be measured by time and distance. That'll probably actually never be well measured in a formula of this kind. A smile, a warm touch, human contact. Mr Speaker, these are all very important. They're not in the formula, but it is our belief they are just as important, and it's our hope that pay recognition goes some way to acknowledging this important sector and the invaluable work that they do.
National Shane Retty ending the third and final debate on the Home and Community Support Payment for Travel Between Clients Settlement Bill. Now to the other hot topic of the week, the TPPA. Here's Rhys Lyon.
New Zealand's chief trade negotiator on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, David Walker, appeared before the Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee on Thursday to face questions from MPs as the committee undertook examination of the 12-nation trade deal. However, Labour MP David Clark grew frustrated with responses to his questions about whether a right to ban foreign property speculators had been sought by former Trade Minister Tim Grosser, as the chief negotiator was reluctant to discuss the fine print.
I've said as much as I'm prepared to say about the detail of the negotiation. We have always said we don't negotiate in public.
Unsatisfied with answers from the chief TPP negotiator David Walker, Labour's export and trade growth spokesman David Clark later put the same question he'd asked in the committee room to the Trade Minister in the chamber.
Did his predecessor, the Honourable Tim Grosser, ask MFAT officials negotiating the TPP agreement to preserve the right for a future New Zealand government to ban the purchase of residential land by non-resident foreign speculators?
That question was fielded on Trade Minister Todd McClay's behalf by his National Party colleague, Paul Goldsmith.
On behalf of the Minister, no. He asked them to preserve the right for a future New Zealand government to restrict the purchase of residential land by non-resident foreigners, which I might add was one of Labour's bottom lines.
David Clark, though, remained unsatisfied his questions had been addressed.
What does it say about his government when they use the opportunity for this Parliament to question them about a trade deal, to demean opponents, refuse to answer straight questions with straight answers, and chuckle in glee at honest discussions about this serious issue?
Paul Goldsmith.
On behalf of the Minister, this government welcomes wide-ranging discussion on the TPP, and that's what we'll be doing over the rest of this year.
Paul Goldsmith, whose National Party colleague, Pasetta Sam Lotoenga, later stood in for Health Minister Jonathan Coleman to field questions from Greens health spokesman Kevin Haig, seeking details on whether the TPPA would affect the cost of prescription medicines in New Zealand.
What is the government's estimate of the likely cost faced by Pharmac for each of the TPP's provisions relating to transparency processes, patent term extensions for pharmaceuticals, and data protection extension for biologics?
Pasetta Sam Lotoenga. Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, I am advised that the TPP will not change the Pharmac model.
Supplementary question, Kevin Hague.
If the United States tries to further extend data protection for biologics, which has been signalled, will the Minister categorically rule out agreeing to that?
Well,
Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, that's a hypothetical question I cannot give an answer to.
And that response echoed trade negotiator David Walker's answers in the committee room earlier in the day.
I have given you the answer to the best of my ability. That is something that I'm not at liberty to discuss in public.
That last remark getting this response from Labour's David Clark.
I think you'll understand my frustration. We're at the start of a hearing and I already feel like I'm losing the will to live.
Labour Party Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee member David Clark. And public submissions on that treaty examination are open until March the 11th. Meanwhile, elsewhere in the committee rooms during the week, on Wednesday the Children's Commissioner Russell Wills appeared before the Social Services Committee for its annual review of his office. And he was back up before the committee soon after to make a submission on a bill which seeks to improve insulation regulations for rental properties. Dr. Wills began his submission by outlining the problem the bill seeks to address.
In New Zealand, we have 42,000 admissions of children a year to our hospitals with illnesses attributable to poverty and poor housing. 15 children a year die of pneumonia, asthma, bronchiolitis and bronchiectasis, the chest infections we see due to this appalling housing. These deaths and hospitalisations are avoidable if we choose.
Dr. Wills said the Residential Tenancies Amendment Bill before the committee stemmed from policies set out in the government's 2013 budget.
Minister English, in his budget of May 2013, announced work on a housing warrant of fitness. We all hoped that we would finally see real progress on housing standards. Government made a promise to our children that day. We will make your houses healthy.
But the Children's Commissioner said the bill failed to do that.
This is not a warrant of fitness, and it is where the promise to children is broken.
Dr. Wills said the bill instead created confusion for renters and landlords.
If your rental house is uninsulated or below the 1978 standard, you as a landlord will be required to insulate to the current code. However, if the house is at the 1978 standard, no further work will be required. Would we think the 1978 standard is good enough for our children? If not, how is it good enough for other children? There should be just one standard, the current code.
The Children's Commissioner put forward several recommendations.
The first is a single standard of insulation for all rental houses. The second is a heating and ventilation standard. And the third is a monitoring or enforcement regime. Surely our children deserve no less.
Children's Commissioner Russell Wills with that submission on the Residential Tenancies Amendment Bill, which is due to be reported back to the House by August the 6th. And earlier in the day, on Wednesday, the Law and Order Committee held the annual review of the Department of Corrections, whose Chief Executive, Ray Smith, defended himself in response to opposition committee members' questions about his handling of problems at Mount Eden Prison.
And I'm happy to put my reputation on the line in the 5 years I've been Chief Executive, and that any time something has gone wrong, and there have been plenty of things, and there will continue to be, in a system that's got 42,000 offenders, things will happen. I have acted.
Corrections Chief Executive Ray Smith speaking to the Law and Order Committee on Wednesday. In total, there were 17 committee meetings held during the week.
That report from Rhys Lyon. Finally, here's the Leader of the House, Gerry Brownlee, to preview what will happen when Parliament resumes after this week's adjournment.
Mr Speaker, when the House resumes on Tuesday the 1st of March, the Government will conclude the debate on the Prime Minister's statement. The Government also intends to make progress on a number of pieces of legislation, including the Building Earthquake Prone Buildings Amendment Bill and the Radiation Safety Bill. Wednesday will be a Members' Day.
Question Time saw health ministers past and present continue their battle of statistics, with Labour's deputy leader and former health minister, Annette King, asking her national successor, Jonathan Coleman, on Tuesday if he stood by a statement he made last week.
That, quote,
I was down there in November announcing the extra $13 million, and that is more than ample to cover the $4 million that Canterbury said it was necessary to cover mental health demands, end quote.
The Honourable Dr. Jonathan Coleman.
Yes, and I quote the Canterbury District Health Board CEO. He said in his written update to staff yesterday, quote, "You may recall we received additional funding late last year. This has enabled the DHB to sustain its level of investment in mental health services while at the same time delivering on a financial break-even position." Quote, close
supplementary break. Question, Mr. Speaker.
Supplementary question, the Honourable Annette King.
Was the Chairman of the District Canterbury District Health Board incorrect when he said at the Select Committee last week that Canterbury DHB had, quote, "a deficit in our budget of $17 million, and the government gave us another $16 million to balance our books. So actually, it was already spoken for. It was actually so we would come in with a zero budget rather than a deficit budget."
The Honourable Dr. Jonathan Coleman.
Well, you know, I can't really see what the member's point is, quite frankly. Canterbury DHB said to us they had a $16 million deficit. We said, yep, we'll fund that up front, and then they will be able to use that money at their discretion to fund whatever services the CEO thinks is appropriate. And he said that some of that money should be used for mental health services, and that's what he's using it for.
Supplementary question, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Annette King.
Did Canterbury DHB receive $222 per head of population for mental health funding for 2015-16, while the national average was $243? If so, why did he say in Parliament last week that he absolutely disputed the DHB's claim?
The Honourable Dr. Jonathan
Coleman. No, what they received was $147 million of ring-fence funding. That's a $23 million increase on 7 years ago. And they'll receive more in this budget because the Canterbury DHB budget has gone up by $254 million over the last 7 years, and it's now at $1.36 billion. That's a huge budget, and the CEO gets to decide how he spends it.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker.
I'd like to table the Canterbury District Health Board CE's update newsletter, quoted by the Minister. It's dated the 15th of February, which they say order, they got order, 20, no, 222.
Order. Member, we'll resume her seat. I'll put the leave. There's no need to further describe it. Leave us sought to table that particular newsletter. Is there any objection? There is none that can be tabled.
Supplementary question,
the Honourable Annette King.
Has Canterbury DHB been told for the 2016-17 financial year that they can expect another decrease of $10 per head for mental health, even less than the 2015-16 funding, and is he still insisting they can live within their budget?
The Honourable Dr. John.
No, they haven't been told that. The member's making it up. Basically, they're getting $147 million this year ring-fenced for mental health. It'll go up next year.
Yeah. Point of order.
I take exception to the minister saying I'm making it up. I've offered to table the information that he quoted where it says they get $10 less.
Order. The member's answer wasn't helpful, but it's hardly disorderly to stand up and say that he disagrees with the figures and the member's making them up. Supplementary
Speaker.
Question, the Honourable Annette King.
What will it take for him to listen to the pleas from staff and the people of Canterbury to take their mental health issues seriously, particularly in light of the latest earthquake and the challenges that they face, like the 20-week wait list for child and family mental health services and a 55% increase in suicide-related call-outs since 2011?
The Honourable Dr. Jonathan
Mr. Speaker, Coleman. Look, I'm in touch with the District Health Board all the time. I've been in touch with the Chair today. The fact is that we have put in an extra $86 million above the population-based funding formula to support Canterbury Health through the earthquake period. We've put in a $950 million hospital rebuild program, $13.5 million in budget 2014 over 4 years for the psychosocial recovery plan. There's a lot going in there. I will be down there regularly. The PM's down there regularly. Canterbury is an absolute top health priority for this government. Sorry, but it's true.
But Annette King obviously didn't think so, and she was back with more questions for the Minister of Health on Thursday, although this time she had to make do with his associate, Pazeta Sam Lotu-Inga.
Will he make good on the promises he made on radio yesterday to Canterbury District Health Board that, quote, If they need more money for mental health this year, they need to tell me exactly what they need, because the government is listening.
Speaker.
The Honourable Pesitar Sam Lottewinger.
On behalf of the Minister, yes.
Supplementary question, Mr Speaker.
Supplementary question, the Honourable Annette King.
Who indicated to Canterbury DHB that for the 2016-17 financial year, they could expect to receive $10 less per head of population, as stated in the very document he quoted from in the House on Tuesday to justify his view they already had sufficient funding?
The Honourable Mr Speaker. Sam Lottewinger.
Mr Speaker, I don't know who that person is, but what I can say is that Canterbury District Health Board spend around $147 million on mental health services, and that's an extra $23 million compared to 7 years ago.
Question, Mr Speaker.
A supplementary question, the Honourable Annette King.
Is he not aware that Canterbury DHB were forced by demand for mental health services to spend $8 million more than the ring-fence mental health funding provided? And perhaps a lack of awareness might account for the plight Cantabrians now face, because ignorance is not a defence.
The Honourable Pesitar Sam Lottewinger.
Well, Mr Speaker, in this House, that member has come up with some pretty dodgy figures in the past, sir. And what I will say, and I'll reiterate to that member, is that there has been an increase, a vast increase in the amount of mental health services funded. So in December just of last year, an extra $16 million was given to the board so that they can address some of the mental health services that have been requested.
Point of order, the Honourable
Annette King. Mr Speaker, I seek leave to table the PricewaterhouseCoopers report commissioned by the Ministry of Health, dated the 2nd of December 2015, page 11, saying they spent $11 more.
Order. Member now will resume her seat. I just want to check whether it's a report that's available publicly to members.
Not readily, Mr Speaker.
Then I will put the leave sought to table that particular PwC report. Is there any objection? There is none that can be tabled.
Supplementary question.
Supplementary question, the Honourable Annette King.
When will he make good on the promise to give Canterbury DHB more money if they, quote, need it, in light of the fact they have already asked and been refused, that he said on Tuesday in this House they had ample to cover mental health demand, and that he is poorly informed about ring-fence funding, deficit support, and even the amount provided?
The Honourable Pesitar Sam Lottewinger.
Well, Mr Speaker, it's rich coming from that member around deficit support, when $150 million in deficits were left by that minister to this government. But, sir, to answer the question...
Order. Point of order, the Honourable Annette.
Speaker, point of order. We have had three answers. The whole three have been abuse thrown at me and not answering
order.
The questions.
Order. No, I don't agree with that. First part of that. Order. The difficulty I have, if it's a nice simple question like when will he make good on the promises, I can help it. But when the question went on considerably more than that, then it's very easy for the minister just to address it in any way he likes. If I can get the minister to sharpen up her supplementary questions, then I might be in a position to help her. Order. Order. The member will rise and simply ask a supplementary question.
Point of order, Mr Speaker.
Point of order, the Honourable Annie.
Point of order, Mr Speaker. I responded to an interjection. Are you going to ask that member not to interject?
No, I'm not. But before you responded to that interjection, you also interjected and criticised me as you rose to your feet. Simply rise and ask your supplementary question.
Supplementary question.
The Honourable Annette.
Has the Ministry of Health told him that the Director of Mental Health, who he said is going down to Christchurch on Friday to talk to the people on the ground, is the same director who said, quote, the Ministry of Health does not consider there is justification to provide additional funding to Canterbury DHB.
The Honourable Pesitar Sam Lottewinger.
Again, on behalf of the Minister, yes, the Director of Mental Health, Dr Crawshaw, is in discussions with the District Health Board, as well as other agencies, to identify whether any further assistance is required on the ground in Christchurch.
Associate Health Minister Bezeta Sam Lottewinger while another Associate Minister, Louise Upston, was also on her feet on Thursday answering questions on behalf of the Minister for Tertiary Education, Skills and Employment, Stephen Joyce, from his Labour shadow, David Cunliffe, who had been doing some digging into allegations of fraud in the tertiary education sector, which is administered by the Tertiary Education Commission, or TEC.
How can the Minister have confidence in TEC and NZQA when a Deloitte review said that coordination between the two is inadequate, when there are now 5 serious fraud office probes into the sector and 35 providers have, and I quote, widespread or serious education delivery issues, 27 of which the names are still being kept secret?
The Honourable Mr. Louise Speaker, Upston.
On behalf of the Minister, the report that member has referred to has found that the broad approach to monitoring tertiary education organisations has the principal elements expected of a comprehensive framework. It also went on to make some additional recommendations to improve monitoring, including the increased use of data analytics, more extensively used both in risk assessment and also in identifying specific issues for review and investigation, as well as improved reporting between both the TEC and NZQA.
Supplementary question, Mr. Speaker.
Supplementary question, the Honourable David Cunliffe.
Mr. Speaker, why did the Minister support TEC's decision not to pursue targeted compliance reviews of 6 institutions now that at least one of those, Quantum Education Group Limited, has since been referred to the Serious Fraud Office?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Louise Upston.
On behalf of the Minister, of the 6 organisations reviewed in the first round, only 5 were found to have no issues at all. It was therefore decided that it would be more cost-effective to undertake the review, the Deloitte review that the member mentioned in an earlier supplementary question. This review found that the monitoring practices are designed well and made a number of additional recommendations to improve and enhance monitoring further. The TEC will continue to monitor organisations it funds. It's using regular an auditing program as well as additional tools like pattern recognition software to identify any concerns. And I add, Mr. Speaker, as I said in my first answer, this is the most robust monitoring by the TEC of the over 730 providers than ever before.
Supplementary question, Mr.
Supplementary
Speaker.
Supplementary question, the Honourable David Cooley.
Mr. Speaker, how can the Minister have confidence in the Tertiary Education Commission when Audit New Zealand has recently audited a heavily qualified audit opinion, which says that its accounts are so imprecise it cannot properly or robustly account for $2.8 billion of public expenditure each year?
The Honourable Louise Upston.
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, I think it's important to put on record the exact issue that member is referring to, because it's very wide of the comments that he has just made. The qualified audit opinion is a result of the TEC not applying the requirements of new, highly technical accounting standards in relation to grant expenditure and financial statements in its 2014-15 annual report. The new standard, Mr. Speaker, needs to be applied consistently by the Ministry of Education, the tertiary education institutions themselves, and the TEC as it relates to the time at which revenue and expenditure is recognised by the various organisations in the funding chain. From the Crown's perspective, these transactions should eliminate on consolidation. So with extensive consultation that's been underway, the TEC decided it was better to partially implement the standards and get it right for the next time.
And one more date to circle on your parliamentary calendar.
The Honourable Bill English.
Well, Mr. Speaker, the budget will be on the 26th of May.
In what will be his 8th budget, Mr. English promises to continue the government's record of fiscal discipline, carrying on up the OECD as stated by his Prime Minister in response to a question on Wednesday.
Wages are going up faster than inflation, the unemployment rate's falling, the economy's rising up the OECD, the country's getting better connected with the rest of the...
Order.
Prime Minister John Key, I'm Tom Frewin, and this programme was made with funding from Parliament.